You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome Shannon Watts back to the podcast. Shannon is the founder of Moms Demand Action, the largest grassroots group fighting gun violence in the U.S. She has been named one of Time's 100 Most Influential People, a Forbes 50 Over 50 Changemaker, and a Glamour Woman of the Year. She has a new book. It's called Fired Up: How to Turn Your Spark into a Flame and Come Alive at Any Age. Enjoy the pod. Shannon Watts, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Is it okay if I get like really deep and philosophical to start with my first question?
I would not want it any other way.
All right. So I was thinking about the story you tell to start the book, the one in the doctor's office, and it made me think that so many of our collective stories around transformation begin in places of struggle and despair. This shows up in literature and movies, but also philosophy. It's Kierkegaard's existential leap of faith. It's what Kerouac meant when he talked about the Beat Generation, which was not just like beaten jazz or beatific. It also meant beaten down. And I wondered why, as humans, we haven't learned to expect that there is no joy without suffering and there's no suffering without joy.
Maybe because joy feels so good.
Yeah. That's
you know, problem. I mean, suffering is suffering and joy is happiness and feeling good. And I think we've sort of been sold this idea, especially in capitalistic culture, that we can always feel good and we can always be happy. And so we seek that out. And it isn't really until the pause that inevitably comes with suffering that we realize there's transformation to be had. You know, I was on autopilot. I'm not even sure that happiness was an issue. I just sort of was living my life in a way that was not true to me without paying attention. And that literally burned me from the inside out. As you said, I found myself in an emergency room covered from head to toe in eczema. And because joy feels so good, you don't really feel like you have to take time to figure out why you feel good. But when you feel bad, you want to figure out how to get out of that.
It's just so funny, though, that you and I have experienced this, right? And artists have experienced it for ages and told us about it. Yet somehow we haven't like fully embraced it as a culture to sort of say, oh, well, I mean, you know, Dickens was writing about this. Shakespeare was writing about this. Like everyone's writing about this. And here we find ourselves. And one of the things that's so, it was interesting. I had a very different experience reading the book than I did writing my notes on the book.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I'm reading the book and I think in some ways I didn't have a frame, you know, for what it was. I saw that you wrote it. So I wanted to have you on because I like you and I like your work. And I had no idea this is what the book was going to be. And I underline my experience in terms of, you know, writing down my questions, what I'm like, oh, this is a treatise from a very personal place, but it is, you know, you're Luther pounding these things on the door for women of a certain age, for humans. I think it's for everyone, but
yeah.
particularly for those of us who decide to make that pivot and sort of saying, you know what, you can do it. And it's very uncomfortable, but you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the zeitgeist, there's so much conversation right now about what, and I think women in particular are doing, right? Like what amazing things that they're accomplishing. When I look at my mother's generation, who was sort of expected to sort of fade away, disappear in midlife, now we're hearing the what. But what I wanted to get to was the how. how do you keep doing these things through your whole life? And maybe you just graduated from college and you're not sure what you want to do. Or maybe, you know, you're a young mom and you don't think you have time to do the things. Or maybe you're an empty nester and you're scared. Or maybe you're toward the end of your life and you don't think it's worth it. But you know, I really want, particularly women, to ask themselves throughout their lives, what do I want? It's this idea that men are taught to follow their desires and women are taught to fulfill their obligations. But also to understand that you should do that forever, that just because you're post-menopause, that doesn't mean that your desires should stop. You should keep pursuing the things you want to do all the way till the end of your life.
We had Jessica Clarko on the podcast. I don't know if you're familiar with her book, Holding It Together, but she has a line where she says, the world has a social safety net. The United States has women. And I think there's more truth in that effing sentence than there is. And that's one of the problems, right? I mean, that you've got, which is especially in terms of the caregiving sense of like where it is unpaid labor that is expected of women. And it's not until you know, in my case, went through a tragedy where those tables got flipped. And in your case, you just found yourself like physically, you know, responding to needing to change. But the structural problem still exists, which is, you know, this is the society we live in. And use this fire metaphor, and I think for very clear terms, and I want you to talk more about that, because I think that fire, you recognize that you can get burned by it.
Yeah, you know, I had this offer to write this book from Maria Shriver, who has a book imprint, and I was really trying to gather my thoughts, because she said, write about what you're called to write about. And so I had all these books and I brought them to my friend's house, who's an author. And she's like, these are very boring. You are a fiery personality. Mm. And it really clicked for me, which is that fire was going to be the metaphor for my book. And living on fire is really a way to figure out two things: what is limiting you and what's calling you. And going back to this idea of women are really taught to fulfill their obligations, these things that become shoulds in our lives, right? I should be a mother. I should stay home. I should focus my time and attention on caretaking as opposed to, you know, what do I want? And how can we make that sort of top of mind for us? And fire, you know, when you're living on fire, a lot of it is, it's almost like alchemy. You know, I didn't figure out how to live this way until I was in my 40s. And it's kind of like touching the divine. It's also formulaic. You know, what I realized is that the formula for it is marrying your abilities, your values, and your desires. That's what I did. And it's not like you figure out, okay, these are my values, these are my abilities, these are my desires. It's a practice that you're going to keep trying over and over again, preferably in the community of other people. But, you know, you were talking about the way the system is set up. It's true. I mean, imagine what would happen if women really prioritized their desires. Institutions would topple, governments would fail, family systems would fall apart, right? Mm-hmm. And so the system is designed to keep us from pursuing those things, or to start believing that our obligations and our shoulds are actually our desires. And I talk about these false desires in the book, right? Like somehow happiness, busyness, purpose, those have become things almost like self-care, right? That have become commodified in a capitalist culture. And can be like a full-time lifetime job. What I'm talking about is fulfillment. These small and big fires in your life that hopefully will burn, fade out, and you start over. But that really is how we should be living our lives, finding fulfillment. And you know, when people are asked, you know, what are you afraid your deathbed regret will be? It's often that I didn't live a life that was true or authentic to me, that I was on autopilot. And I just don't want any woman to get to the end of their life and feel like they didn't burn.
Dan Pink's last book is about regret. And one of the things that he notes in the research that he did, which is no one regrets their actions. They regret their inaction.
Yes.
They didn't take that chance. They didn't make that phone call. They didn't jump off the train when they saw that person that they thought they should connect with. And when you know that, if you can embody that, it really is a clarion call to act, you know. And the other thing that he talks about in this book is count how many weekends you think you have left talking to your kids.
That's so interesting.
So it's sobering in the sense of like, okay, where am I going to put my attention then? I'm going to make sure my attention is on them.
But I think that can be for women a little bit of a double-edged sword, because of the 70 women I interviewed for this book, I asked them what they were worried their deathbed regret would be. Almost all of them who were mothers said that I pursued my desires at the expense of my children, that somehow investing in yourself, your life will be detrimental. You know, I'm on the other side of that chasm. I have all grown children, and not one of them says to me, I can't believe you didn't go to that soccer game in 2006 or the fourth showing of my Peter Pan play in high school. It's, Mom, I'm so glad you had something to focus on in your life other than just me. And thank you for creating an example that I can follow as an adult to live in the same way.
That's a great note. Very similar experience. The way our adult son talks to us is he's very proud of our personal accomplishments and the fact that we go out and see theater and that we go see music and that we're living our lives. He doesn't look that it's in service of him. And I think that certainly for me, I'm the youngest of six boys. There was no sense that there was parenting going on.
No.
There was food on the table. I had clothes to wear to school. I had options, which was great. But it's like my activities were not monitored. There was no cell phone. There was no, it was like, hey, just be home by the time the street lamps are fully lit and it's dark outside.
Yep. Sounds like an 80s childhood.
Yeah, 70s, 80s childhood for sure. So I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, where you found your fire formula, because you have a very powerful story you tell about going to this yoga class. This is like Sandy Hook just happened. You probably heard about it on the radio.
Oh, no, I was watching TV and folding clothes in my bedroom.
All right. And then you had a yoga class that you had to go to, or you were scheduled.
The next morning, yes. So, okay. You know, I was like everyone else in the world, just devastated. I went to bed in tears. And then when I woke up, that sadness had at some point in the middle of the night turned into abject rage. And I really felt like I had to do something. I had to act. I hilariously was enrolled to become a yoga teacher. If anyone knows me, you know, you would know that I would make a horrible yoga teacher. I'm very type A, but it was something I was trying. I was trying all of these different things in my life to figure out, you know, what did I want, right? It's this idea of who am I? What do I want? And so I got to yoga class and nobody mentioned that 20 children and six educators had just been murdered inside an elementary school. And I just couldn't believe that we could all act like nothing had happened. And I folded up my yoga mat, I got in my car and I went home. And that's when I opened up my laptop and I started this Facebook page that became Moms Demand Action. But it was such a clarion call for me, that shooting. And I knew it would be for other women and mothers too, you know. Speaking of the 70s and 80s, right? Like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but it had a profound impact on me. I can remember sitting in my math class and looking out the window and these badass women like were hauling a car onto the school grounds that was all crumpled up and still had blood on the outside of it from a horrific accident. And, you know, these mothers were not messing around. Mm-hmm. And they made such an impact in such a short amount of time. And I thought mothers and women can do this on guns too.
So this comes up in the book, which is this finding this balance between self-care and the care of the world, which feels to me like it's never going away, that becomes this. It's in the same way. I had a guest one time who said she didn't like the term work-life balance. She preferred work-life sway because we're always doing this. I think that's a similar thing to what you need to do in terms of. And all the activists I know, and I know a lot of them, are people who really love to laugh.
Mm.
And the sort of joyous warrior thing, in part because they have to, because if the activism came with just the tears, it's like, that's
yes.
too much.
Yes. Do you swear on this podcast?
You can.
Okay. Well, I call this the double bind of fucksgiving.
Yes.
Which is that women are supposed to be soft and hard in the world. Like we have to give all the fucks, but also give no fucks. Mm-hmm. And that is a pretty impossible predicament. And I talk about how do you navigate that in this book? You know, it's a real double bind because if you want to get involved, you have to care. But when you get involved, you have to realize you're going to get blowback and you can't care about that. And so we could all use a handbook on how to do that. And then the other thing you brought up is joy. Mm-hmm. There is no activism without joy. There is no activism without joy. You cannot get people, you might get them to show up, but they're not going to stay and keep coming back if there's no joy. And I can remember early on when I started Moms to Men Action, we started having an annual event called Gun Sense University, which we still have to this day. And it was a whole weekend where people came from across the country, all our leaders, to get trained and to interact with gun violence survivors and to, you know, have camaraderie. And we decided at the very end, we were going to do a huge dance party. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm talking about like DJ, kick off your shoes. It's light, like go ham. And I had a few people say to me, like, is this really appropriate? This doesn't seem to be in keeping with the mood of the issue. And I just knew they were wrong. I knew that it was important to end the weekend on a note of joy. And that was the thing that people most enjoyed from that whole weekend. It was the thing that they said, I can't wait to come back and do another dance party. Like, thank you for getting me through all the difficult parts. That was important, but I'm really glad we ended with joy. And it's a discipline in a way, right? To stay hopeful, to stay joyful, to celebrate.
So there's quite a few people that you profile in here that we've had on the podcast. One of them is Susan McPherson, who wrote The Lost Art of
Yes.
And one of the things we're getting at here that she talks about is this need that we all have to live in community, to connect with each other. There's the famous Harvard study that shows the key to happiness is people's relationships over a long period of time. And key to know inside that, it doesn't mean those relationships are like hunky-dory 100% of the time. They're absolutely not. But they are in connection. And one of the reasons I'm always, like I just said today, I was on the radio talking about AI because everyone wants to talk about AI. And I'm fascinated by what it can do. I also recognize that there will never be a replacement for people coming together in a small, dark room to laugh at Second City comedians improvising like magic in front of them. And that they're not going to do the same thing for coming to look at on a screen.
Right.
And you talk about this quite a bit in the book that you need your people and,
yes.
and ever expanding groups and rings of people. Not everyone needs to be your best friend, but yeah. Having those connections.
You know, we, as I said, it's not that hard to get people to come to something. It is hard to get them to stay. And, you know, when you see a shooting tragedy in the news or your kid goes through a lockdown drill, you might sign up as a volunteer. But why do you keep coming back? So we pulled our volunteers to ask them this question and they said two things. One is the one is that they felt like they were winning. You know, we always made it a practice to celebrate every win, no matter how small. And we even had a phrase called losing forward. So when you lose, you win, you learn how to win the next time, right? Because when you take on the most wealthy, powerful special interests that's ever existed, you're going to lose. So how do you reframe that to make sure people don't feel defeated? The second thing they said was that they found their people. Like even in the reddest of states, they found like-minded people, regardless of political party, whose values were about protecting their families and their communities. And when you find your people, you don't want to let them down. You want to keep showing up because you want them in your life. And it's a real inspiration to keep coming back and doing the work. And that's certainly what I found. I mean, I've lived in three different states since I started Moms to Men Action, and all the people I meet are moms volunteers. And those are the people that become my friends. And I talk about this in the book as a bonfire, because the people you meet when you are living on fire, when you're pursuing your desires, those are the people that will help you start your next fire, right? And they'll be with you for the rest of your life. And I just think post-pandemic and in a world that is so online, you know, we all struggle with connection. We all struggle with those friendships that we have to have in real life. You know, my husband is wonderful, but it's not the same as spending time with a group of other women. There's just a different kind of fortification that I need and want. And I also find that friendship, especially as you get older, might be a little more of an effort, right? I got to be in my 50s, and even though I had friends, I didn't have close friends. I didn't have friends that I thought I could call in the middle of the night during an emergency. And I actually set out on a journey to find those friends. And I've made some. But it's something that I have found resonates with other women, which is like, how do I not just live a life that is true and authentic to me, but how do I also do it in community?
I think there's an element of, as you get older, recognizing that you think it should be easier. It's never easier. You develop coping skills and other things. But I think it's true for both my wife and I, that we've made some of our best friends in the last 10 years of our life, in part because we put ourselves in spaces that were kind of vulnerable, that when we were working sort of in that flow state of just maybe beyond our capability with people in these, whether it's an academic or an activist area or whatever, a caregiving area. And the payoff is so huge, because when you're part of that struggle with someone else, you form these incredible bonds, but it does require you putting yourself out there in a way that is anything but easy.
Oh, it's not. I mean, it can be terrifying to be vulnerable, right? And I mean, I think it's the same skill set to figure out what you want and to go after it as it does to form a friendship. You have to be vulnerable. You have to work at it as though it is a practice. You have to nurture it and keep it going. And it can be terrifying, but I'm not sure it's as terrifying as not having those connections. You have to decide it's worth a trade-off.
That's right. Another person you talk about is Samara Bay, who was inspired, was a sort of storyteller inspired by seeing Shakespeare. And she has this wonderful quote in the book that you cite. She says, quote, "If we all believe our weird small stories are good enough, it will change the world." That's the best.
It's so good. I mean, you know, I had a debilitating fear of public speaking when I started Moms in Action. In fact, if you had told me I was going to have to do public speaking, I probably wouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. That's how much I was terrified. I can see myself at my very first event where it was freezing cold winter day right after the shooting, and I had a cup of coffee in my hand and I couldn't even keep coffee in the cup. My hands were shaking so violently. I was terrified of public speaking. And what I realized was the way I reframed it to stop being so afraid was that these people want to hear my small, weird story, right? These people want to know how to act, and they want to just learn, and they're not judging me. Maybe some of them are, but that's not the point. That's not why they're there. And the thing I hear so many times from women, especially women who are middle-aged or older, is when we talk about, like, you have these great ideas, why aren't you pursuing them? It's often because who would want to hear it? I'm too old. It's too late. There's no way to get it done in my lifetime. And just none of that is true, right? That is buying into what the system tells us, that we don't have time, or we're not important enough, or what we think won't work. And I want us to stop living that way. You know, it's more about, what do I want and how do I try it? What do I learn along the way? How do I get on that journey and that path toward that thing? You know, I talked about interviewing 70 women for this book. I interviewed Sandra Cisneros. She's in her 70s. She said, "I still haven't written my best poem." She's like a renowned author and poet. I talked to a woman who, this is my favorite story. She retired from being a gym teacher. She had always wanted to be a writer. She teaches herself how to write a book after she retires in her 60s. She writes a book, a love story about a couple that falls in love at an animal shelter. She decides she wants to get it published. She doesn't want to self-publish. She's worthy of having her book published. She gets 218 rejection letters. 218. Like, imagine sending it out that many times. On the 219th time, she finally gets a book deal from a guy who really loves dogs. It's books about, you know, a couple, the animal shelter. And she becomes a published author in her 70s, right? So it isn't too late. You're not too old. You can still do these things, but you do have to try.
One of the things that when we're teaching people to do this work in improvisation, the very first beginning thing we say is that the thing that is stopping us, that stops you from doing this, is your fear and shame brain. But it's also judgment, and judgment of self and judgment of others. And of those two things, what do you think is more prominently playing? Everyone says judgment of self.
Yes.
So it's not that we don't know. The group knows. I've done thousands of these presentations. They always say judgment of self. Judgment of self. They know. We know. It's like my first question, which is these forces are so powerful that even though we all know them, they are the things that are holding us back because we're telling ourselves a story that yes. is not true. No one buys a ticket to a show hoping it sucks. and no one, let's say it's free. We're not going there and like, I really hope this person disappoints me. We're going to be looking for the wisdom. Yes. We're going to be looking for the thing of interest. And even if it's mostly boring, we're going to be like, this one or two points are really good. Like, that's the thing. Like, whatever, like know that. And if you recognize the fact that people generally want you to succeed, and I think that's overwhelmingly true.
Yes.
I think that it's a very small group of anarchists who maybe don't want that to happen. One or two. That changes the whole equation.
Yes.
And gives you an opportunity to transcend, self-actualize, transcend, and do all the things you need to do. And I think to your point, which is this doesn't, it's not just the domain of 20-year-olds.
No, it isn't. I mean, as I said, I'm 54. I have so much more wisdom to offer the world. And I often also deserve to fulfill my desires, right? And I feel in many ways like I'm just getting started. And if we reframed it that way, that we want to leave a legacy. I know legacy is sort of a loaded word. You know, you think about like a man whose name is on the side of a hospital building or who has started a philanthropy, but it isn't that. A legacy is simply knowing that you did all of the things that you wanted to do. That could be having a tough conversation. It could be going to therapy. It could be leaving your marriage. It could be a whole host of things. It could be political, professional, or personal, right? But knowing that you tried to do those things, I think, is incredibly important. And that's really what legacy is all about.
When I read, so in chapter 11, which is called Bonfire, I read a line that you wrote. You say, quote, "A simple but powerful way to build trust with your friends is to be honest about your struggles," end quote. Here's what I thought back to a podcast we had with Kurt Gray, who wrote a book called Outrage about the divide between right and left. And one of his sort of scientific discoveries over time has been one of the only ways that he has found that people can successfully talk across difference, like political difference, is through storytelling, but shared harm. Mm. When people can acknowledge how they feel harmed or their worries about harm, that people respond to that. I get booked often to speak to groups that are politically not aligned with me for whatever reason. And they always respond terrifically to the things I'm saying, all of which are informed by how I feel politically and seem like, well, they must not be to you, but that's just not the case. I mean, it's like there are other factors involved. So sort of curious in thinking about that, because, you know, you talk about the harm that you've experienced. And I'm curious in terms of speaking to people across that divide, whether that's been productive for you in any sort of experience you've had.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that we're all told that this is a very polarizing issue and like half the country supports gun safety and half doesn't. And that really isn't true. You know, the only place this is polarizing is in state legislatures and in Congress. When you talk to average Americans, I think they agree on much more than they don't.
Yeah.
Will there always be a very vocal minority of gun extremists who think any law whatsoever is an infringement on the Second Amendment? Yes. There's an interesting anecdote. I was in Missouri talking to some volunteers who had run for office and won, and now they're state legislators. And, you know, that's a pretty red state. And they live in rural Kansas City. And they said that they were knocking on doors when they were running for election. And Republicans would answer the door and say, "You can put your signs in my yard because I'm afraid my kids aren't safe in their schools." And when you look at polling, Republican women and Democratic women agree on the same solutions for gun violence. So what you realize when you dare to have the conversations, which you might go into with trepidation, is that, like you said, you do agree on much more than you disagree on. And if you have data, you can sometimes convince people. I'm thinking about, you know, I was on a vacation and we were, again, back to Missouri. There was a couple there from Missouri. And they were telling me, you know, they're gun owners, they live in a rural area, and they kept loaded guns in between their mattresses. And they have grandchildren. And I didn't go into it judgmentally. I didn't say, "How dare you? You know, this is incredibly dangerous." I said, "Did you know that, you know, easy access to guns inside your home is the main reason for children's deaths? Gun violence is the number one cause of death among children in America right now. that if you securely store your firearm, you can absolutely protect that child from harm of any kind. And it's still easy to access your gun. You know, you can get a biometric safe. I just had all the conversation and the data and the information. And I don't think the husband was convinced. However, as I was leaving, the woman came out and took me by the arm and just said, "I'm really glad you told me that. I'm gonna go get safes."
Mm, wow. Well, and that took having that conversation.
Yeah.
And what, you know, unfortunately, especially in the last few years, it feels like people don't want to even have the conversation. And it's just like, if you want to play the zero sum game, I don't get that, because it doesn't work. It's like, it's literally, we have to do this together. That is the only way we do this.
We have to do this together. But also, if you really do want to change hearts and minds, you can't do it, you know, through osmosis. You're going to have conversations with people. I just moved from California to Florida.
Yeah,
I'm a blue dot in a very red state, you know, and I've already met my neighbors, and they have a sign in their yard that says Gulf of America. I'm pretty sure I understand where they are, but they were very kind and welcoming to me and brought me, you know, a box of chocolates to welcome me to the neighborhood. And, you know, I'll be interested in seeing how they react to who I am and what I do.
All right, what took you to Florida? I'm very curious about this.
My husband's job. So during the pandemic, his offices all moved from the East Bay to the Tampa area. But look, I have lived in 10 states, many of them very red, from Texas to Missouri to Indiana. And so this is not new for me. And it's actually kind of invigorating, because it's not that hard to be an activist in California.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's nice to pass even stronger laws that can be replicated in other states, but there's something to be said for being the underdog.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. I enjoy on the Yes And podcast talking about the importance of saying no, because that's not easy for everyone. And I wonder, for you, was that an act? Is that something you had to learn over time, saying no?
I think I'd like to say yes. And I've thought about, why do I like to say yes? And it's not because I'm a people pleaser. That is not me. It is because I'm afraid I'm going to miss out on an opportunity, or because I feel very confident that I can do a million things at once. And sometimes I end up over promising. And so that ends up being harmful to other people, right? Like, if I overpromise, or if I'm only doing something for self-gratification, not because it's, you know, something that's beneficial. So I really am getting better as I get older at saying no, because I think it's the kindest thing to do to other people, to not overpromise and commit to something that I can't follow through on.
There's an interesting study that was done recently by one of my guests, where they did a test with a bunch of students. And so half the students were brought into a room, and they said to them, all right, can you unlock your cell phone and hand it to me? I'm going to go out in the hallway and do some stuff to it. And most of them actually did do that. And actually, I think they even added on, you know, if you don't want me to, that's fine, kind of thing. And then the other group that they did the same thing. They said, can you unlock this? I'm going to take it out and do some stuff in the hallway. And if you don't want me to do that, just say, Kelly, I don't want you to do that. That group overwhelmingly said no, they didn't want them to do it. And what we sort of drew out of this study was that if you give people a script, they're more likely to be able to say no, which I found interesting as an improv guy, recognizing that improvisation is very useful when you're making something out of nothing, but you are in places sometimes where you need a script, and usually that's where you need a boundary.
Mm.
And so this idea of like, so what I start to do now, especially with younger colleagues, if I like, it's an extra piece of work or whatever, I'm like, hey, and if this is too much that's on your plate, just say, Kelly, it's too much on your plate. I have found people, and not everyone says no to that, but then they'll also feel like they have more agency in the situation.
Yes.
And I found that interesting and sort of curious in your spaces when you run through this, because you're asking people to do things that are not comfortable.
Yeah. And you do have to be sensitive. You know, I remember a volunteer said to me, didn't want to use their last name in a media interview. And I was kind of saying, like, that impacts our credibility, you know, and she said, Shannon, I am not Malala. Like, I am not brave enough to do this. And, you know, that was sort of like self-denigrating, but the reality is some people just aren't comfortable doing things that, you know, that might result in conflict. And I completely get that. And I respect that. And I just think as a leader, it's important to always help people get to yes, whatever that means for them, but also for me to get to yes. So I have to listen to those no's, because if you put pressure on people to do things they don't want to do, you know, you're going to lose them and they're not going to be interested and they're going to feel like they've been bullied or pressured. And so I happen to be a very strong personality. I am always trying to give people the option to say no to me, because I think it isn't easy to say no to me. You could ask my kids that. They would probably tell you that's true. And so I'm always going overboard to make sure that that isn't an option.
Yeah. Well, I guess a no can be a yes and to yourself or to someone else. The other thing I wanted to, it's funny because usually when I get towards the end of the book, I just write down words that, and I wrote down martyrdom. Yeah. So why did Kelly write down martyrdom in the notes of reading your book?
I talk in the book about what I call extinguishers, in keeping with a fire metaphor. And it's this idea of like, you're going to get blowback. You're going to feel guilt and shame. And as a result, you're going to go into these behaviors that are comfortable. And that can impact your ability to sort of live on fire. And what I found when I started Moms Demand Action was that I felt guilty, I think in part because, you know, I wasn't a gun violence survivor. I was just this mom and also a white suburban mom, right, who got involved because of a mass shooting, not the daily gun violence that was going on 30 miles from my home. And I think I felt shame by, you know, being so publicly out in front and just, you know, kind of the baggage that comes with being a woman in the spotlight. And so I think and I'm only saying this in retrospect because I didn't realize it was happening at the time, but I didn't get paid for 11 years. I was a full-time volunteer, even though the other people in the organization, especially the men, were, you know, making plenty of money. I never took a dollar. In fact, I gave all my book proceeds, all of my speaking proceeds. I was even a donor to the organization. And I think I thought I was going to be protected from blowback by being a good girl. Hmm. Like somehow martyring myself would protect me from feeling uncomfortable or having other people criticize me. And I can see now in hindsight that I didn't, that wasn't the right thing to do. It wasn't great for my own self-fulfillment and esteem. But also I think I set a bad example for other women. There's this thing called the passion tax, it's this idea, particularly around women, that if they are passionate about something, if they feel strongly about it, if they want to get out involved in the goodness of their heart, that is reward enough. They don't need financial compensation. And I think that's something we got to talk more about. You know, that's a real thing.
So the order here was martyrdom, passion tax, and then reframe. And the reason I wrote down reframe, which is, wow, if I had known about reframes, you know, 30, 40 years ago, what a superpower to understand that for ourselves and for others, that, you know, it's a minor move. It can be a minor move. It can be a centimeter move that makes all the changes in the world in terms of, I had my friend Liz Joint Sandberg, who's a wonderful improviser and teacher. She was fooling around with stand-up, and she had someone heckle her. And she decided to, like, do the classic improv thing, is replace blame with curiosity. And she's like, I'm really curious why at this point in the show you felt the need to heckle me. It became this really funny, interesting dialogue that she ended up having with this person that she never would have had of if she just did her normal, I'm either going to shut them down, ignore it, whatever, do that. And she decided just to do a reframe. And I think that the more we could teach people the ability to not just reframe things for themselves, which is fantastic, but recognize that for others, they might just need a reframe, that could change the world.
Yeah. No, I love that. I mean, by reframe, explain what you mean by reframe.
What I mean by reframe is you can, you know, the only agency we have in many of these situations is not the thing that is happening to us. It's our emotional response to the thing that's happening to us. So if we just decide that we're not going to be completely thrown by this thing, that we're going to ask a question, look for a follow-up, maybe assume that we didn't hear everything or that this person didn't express themselves the right way. And almost, in my experience, 95% of the time, you learn enough that you're like, okay, my initial response did not need to be my initial response.
I mean, I believe all of activism, maybe all of life, is really about storytelling, right? It's all a narrative, and you can tell the narrative negatively or you can tell it positively. When we started Moms Demand Action, you know, we knew we would lose. We were taking on this powerful, wealthy special interest. So how do you get people to accept losing? You call it losing forward. So even when you lose, you learn something so you can win the next time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that is part of storytelling. It becomes part of the narrative that you're going to be playing the long game, that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And that incrementalism leads to revolutions. I also think, you know, reframing around hope versus cynicism. Mm-hmm. I've had so many people say to me, like, don't you feel so hopeless? Like, isn't this work so hard? You're always losing. And that's not my experience. But also, I just think cynicism is an excuse for inaction. If you're telling yourself the story and the narrative that you're never going to win and this is an impossible feat, then that becomes the outcome. But if it's a reframe, looking at it like, I'm going to choose to be hopeful every single day, because being hopeful will encourage me to act. And then let me tell you all the ways that we are winning. That's why I have hope, right? And it's funny, because I just think when you are an activist, or maybe this is the same for the work world and even in your personal life, like, the more you reframe it to be positive, the more likely you're to stick with it.
Yeah, which doesn't mean it needs to be toxic positivity.
No,
you're not like making crap up. You are simply looking at the reality of a situation and recognizing it's multifaceted.
Yes.
This leads perfectly into my last question, which is for a thank you because story. So the backstory on this was, we were working with behavioral scientists at the University of Chicago. We were doing the yes and exercise and improv, and they're like, there's already science to back up why yes and works, which is, in behavioral economics, we know people's default is to say nothing, you know, or do nothing, just stay idle. And yes and is a nudge to do differently. Great. And then they ask the question, but what do you do when you don't want to yes and someone, but you kind of have to stay inside the conversation? So the exercise we create is based on science, and it's called thank you because, and we pick a minor disagreement, like Pepsi versus Coke, dogs versus cats. So we have people argue that and try to convince each other they're right. But in the second round, we say, now you're going to use a technique, which is, before you respond to the other person, you have to say thank you to what they just said. And the because is where you find something of value in what they said, no matter how small. And what we discover is, through that, through this idea of some gratitude and actually trying to see someone, you find connectedness. You build a different story together. And a lot of people are like, no, I learned stuff. And I started to think, okay, you know, like, this is like, and these are minor disagreements we're talking about. So we'd like to ask guests who come back the second time if they've ever used a technique kind of like that, where they use gratitude and seeing people to bridge a divide.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at Moms Demand Action, I can remember we showed up in Maryland and there were all these people with signs protesting a bill that would have disarmed domestic abusers. And that seemed kind of absurd. You know, why would you oppose a bill that was going to protect mostly women from gun violence? And we, instead of, you know, ignoring them or being combative, we went over and decided to talk to them. And the more we talked about the bill and what it did, the more that we realized we had a lot of common ground. And in fact, they ended up taking their signs and going home. Mm-hmm. Another example I would say was my own dad. You know, when I started Moms Demand Action, he was not supportive. Mm-hmm. He's a gun owner. He thought that I was undermining, you know, America's Constitution, trying to undo the Second Amendment. And it took a lot of conversation, you know, about really what was my goal, just to restore the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. What were the facts about gun violence in America? You know, I think he had digested a lot of things, a lot of the disinformation that has been out there for decades. And then also, you know, knowing me and understanding, you know, that I have integrity and that I wouldn't be working on something that was subversive necessarily. And, you know, eventually it took a lot of time and a lot of conversation, but I remember getting the very first picture of he and my stepmom and their Moms Demand Action shirts at a rally where he lives in Illinois.
Oh, that's great. I love that. The book is called Fired Up, How to Turn Your Spark into a Flame and Come Alive at Any Age. Shannon Watts, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.